thing. I don't have much to add here. I looked up the Spiel des Jahres standards, the rubric they use to grade the games that they rate as best games for each particular year. And I thought those had some interesting insight into this as well. The criteria breakdown is game concept, which is originality, playability, game value. Rule structure, the composition, the clearness, and the comprehensibility. Layout, box board, and rules. And design, functionality, and workmanship. And it occurs to me that a lot of these criteria that evaluate how successful and how, or not how successful, how good a game is, also a large number of them are protected by copyright and trademark law instead of patent. If you'll recall, I think there were a different set of people here when I spoke last Thursday. my theory is that board games, well, the mechanics of board games are protected by patents. The fact that they're protected by trademarks and copyrights is usually sufficient, and as a general rule, more practical than applying patent protection. And so, as such, while there is patent protection for games, it's not very well utilized, and it doesn't seem to be necessary for the functioning of the board game market. I'll just open up for questions, discussion.
I had a question.
Sure.
Could Blizzard, not Blizzard, I guess Wizards of the Coasts claim a business method patent for Magic the Plague?
Yes, that was one of the questions we walked out of last week. They do have a number of patents on Magic the Gathering in a bunch of different ways, and some of the ones that they enforce are the mechanic of tapping the cards and using that to denote that whatever resource that card represents has been expended, which they have used to enforce kind of with threatening letters. There's been no litigation on it. And the business method itself, I don't believe, is patented, but they do have a number of patents protecting some.
Has anybody else done it before? Because that was one of the neat things, economically speaking. People who aren't familiar with Magic, it's basically a system where there is, in principle, an unlimited number of different cards, and they release new ones from time to time and sell them, and you can get a stronger deck, or at least a deck stronger against some of the existing decks, by buying additional cards, so they've got a sort of a steady revenue stream. Coming in.
They've got an artificial rarity built into it, so only some cards they'll print 100 of, some cards they'll print 1,000,000 of, and depending on which cards you need, the value of those cards fluctuates immensely.
And it's analogous, if you think about one of the ways in which people have tried funding online games, is to say that you can play our game for free, you can get armor and weapons playing the game, but you can also buy armor and weapons with real cash, and that gives you a revenue source, and that's really an analogous method. And I was just sort of thinking about whether Wizards had a patent, and if so, it would apply to that. But there may be earlier versions that are equivalent.
Magic was the first to do something like that with card games. They did not do a patent on the business method, mm-hmm. and as such, they probably wouldn't be able to preclude an online pay-to-win game from using that particular. But it's conceivable that would qualify as a business patent. It's in the realm of what can be granted for it.
Are there other things like that that were done before that in the non-card game version?
I can tell you the biggest analogies drawn are with baseball playing cards, which also have some kind of artificial rarity built in, but not the particular business method of incorporating it with a game.
All right. Other people have questions?
I guess it's sort of a monolayer, though maybe completely off scope. But and I haven't been in the market for it, but there are there have been sales where characters of, say, World of Warcraft or game characters are sold. They're built up and then sold at a high level. Mm-hmm. Is that infringed?
That's
kind of copyright or patents?
Usually what that infringes is the end-user license agreement. Usually that's written in there about that. I don't think anybody's protected it on like a copyright infringement just because the EULA is such a stronger case for it. But that's way outside the scope of what I'm talking about.
I just thinking there's some mechanics for perhaps some smaller subset of the
game. It's in a way analogous to what Wizards is doing. It's just that it's being produced by the player, not by the company.
And resale is encouraged. There's a
a robust secondary market for Magic cards on the internet, that's on eBay, and that's just not.
Yes, but on the other hand, I think that Blizzard discourages, though I don't think they can do much about it, the sale of characters.
Oh yeah, definitely.
Can people see why they would? Because it's an interesting issue. That is, why doesn't Blizzard say, "Wonderful, we're going to have people who pay us for the cost of playing the game. They build up a character. They get tired, sell it to somebody else. That makes people more willing to."
I always think there's a lot of time and investment that goes into building a character from level 0 to level 7 or 8 or pal 9, whatever the time.
90 now.
That time would be spent. The resources that are used in investing that those expenses go to the company as opposed to building up a character and selling it as is and then some kind of rewrites off.
I think Blizzard disagrees with you. And on that particular point, my evidence for that is that one of the common complaints nowadays is they've made getting to 90 much too easy. That my wife indeed has been complaining that she got one of her characters, I don't know, 80, but most of the way, using, I think, only a single spell or a single attack or something, because they'd nerfed the game so badly. And I think what's going on at the moment, as far as I can tell, is they're putting most of their effort into end game material, and have therefore followed a strategy of making it easier to go up the early levels. I know I haven't leveled a character for a very long time, so I don't know, but that's what I'm told. But it's an interesting issue, because if you're thinking about the designs of these things, can anybody think of why Blizzard, aside from the reason you're giving, are there other reasons why Blizzard might prefer that people not be buying high-level characters? How about as a player? Is there a reason you might prefer that other people not be buying high-level characters?
Yeah, it's going to undermine the achievement of whoever actually went through and did all this stuff.
That's one reason. Is there another reason?
And you have to play with the people who don't know what they're doing.
That's the other reason, is concern that when some level 90 character joins your raid, you assume he's confident. But in fact, if he is what is referred to in the trade as an eBay character, he's only been playing it for 3 days, he's got no idea what he's doing, and so your group wipes repeatedly because he keeps doing the wrong thing. So that seems to be an interesting, if you just sort of think about the logic of what's going on, it's an interesting feature of it, that there is this kind of interdependence going on.
But that same problem comes in just when Blizzard reduces the difficulty.
That's right, absolutely. Level. Precisely that problem. Yeah, as I was saying, I'm familiar with this mostly from my wife's complaint. She plays World of Warcraft much more than I do. But other people with comments for our today's speaker? Can I give you an interesting paper?
Round another interesting paper, seeing with all of this stuff in it.
Right, good, great. And I think we've got our next one.
Yeah, Act 7 brief PowerPoint, is there?
If you know how this thing works, sure. Do you know where to plug it in? Or how do you, are you putting it in your laptop, or are you putting it in a flash drive? Or what?
I was assuming that we could project this, right?
Yeah. But you've got to, how do you get it? You've got a flash drive.
Yes.
A flash drive in this machine is down there. Here's the keyboard. You can, assuming you know Windows, which I don't.
Yeah,
I'll usually figure out how to
figure that out. It's just a brief one to guide the first few minutes or so. And then projecting it onto.
That's this thing, and we want to do it with PC. Yeah, starting it up. The rest of the room should be able to see what you're doing very shortly.
Okay. Now I just want to.
Another couple of seconds. Turn the lights down. It says room PC is for the selected.
Oh, there's the screen.
I'm afraid I'm going to knock this off.
Great. There's the screen. You've got it.
All right. So, my topic was looking at a new, I hesitate to say technology, but technologies that bring us into what's often called an augmented reality, and I'll get into explaining that in a bit. But I wanted to explore its implications upon IP theory. So just to get everyone sort of in the mood here, I have one of my favorite movie scenes, is there? Definitely not. This is from Terminator 2. So, as you can see, all this information is overlaid over reality. He's definitely scanning people to see if their clothes are going to fit him.
I need your clothes, your boots, and your motorcycle.
Anyway. So, that was sort of a vision from the 80s, or that was the 90s, early 90s, I think, of, you know, what life could be like if we could look out and see things that are happening in real time and have digital data overlaid on our vision so that we could make certain decisions that would sort of augment our reality. The purpose of my paper was to, we're seeing more and more technology that's headed in this direction. Obviously nothing that's that good at all yet. And of course he was a Terminator. So anyway, the purpose of my paper was to identify some areas of intellectual property law that may be particularly affected by augmented reality applications, mostly within copyright and trademark law. And to pose hypotheticals that portray the complexity of these issues and sort of recommend judicial outcomes that are consistent with the prevailing theoretical justifications for that particular intellectual property right. But today, since I just have a shorter time, I sort of wanted to address some of the primary feedback I had on my paper from Professor Freeman, which was that I need to be much clearer about how I'm describing augmented reality and other certain terms that I use in the paper, because that matters a lot when we're trying to determine, you know, the boundaries of what the law ought to be. So, you know, defining augmented reality is difficult. One prominent scholar, when asked about it, his answer was drugs. But to be a little more specific, and a different commentator had a definition that I like better, is simply overlaying digital data on the physical world. And it's important not to confuse with the technology that overlays that data itself. And the reason why is that because the same technology can have certain applications that are augmented reality-esque and some that aren't. And Google Glass is one of those, and I'll be getting into that in a little bit. But mainly, you want to contrast. So there's the physical reality, which is, you know, look around you. We have our five senses, and we experience the physical world. And then you have virtual reality. Think, you know, video games or World of Warcraft or something like that, where there's some sort of alternate reality where we're looking into a screen or something like that. And augmented reality is somewhere in between there. We're looking at our physical world, but we're overlaying digital data that we've created over it. The problem is where we draw the line, and where we draw the line is definitely important to the analysis. So one of the things Professor Friedman brought up was, what about heads-up displays? So I think that the answer is yes in this regard. There's questions as to what would be the scope of protection. So heads-up displays, it's been used for a long time now in fighter jets, where they're sort of using these markers to track, you know, where certain things are. But it is overlaying digital data over physical reality, which is just what the pilot is seeing through the window. The other alternative is, you know, what about Google Glass? And this is getting into that distinction that I was mentioning earlier. This is a video put out by Google to show people using Google Glass. And I won't watch this whole video, but...
Okay, Glass, record a video.
This crunchy.
Okay, Glass, hang out with the flying bug.
Google Photos and Tiger Heads.
You ready? You ready?
Right there. Okay, Glass, take a picture.
Anyway, as you can see, a lot of what people are using that for is not necessarily augmented reality. It's sort of just a head-mounted camera, which has existed for quite a while. This is just, you know, sort of a highly efficient one, and that we wouldn't probably consider as augmented reality because the primary purpose of it is not to overlay data on our physical realm. It's just to sort of capture video or pictures and whatnot. But that's not to say that Google Glass isn't capable of something that would be considered physical reality or augmented reality. I don't know why this isn't working. So this is an example of someone that is using Google Glass for augmented reality purposes. So in this situation, they are looking through the...
Someone with glasses shop at a store for several people who are able to visually direct the wearer to items they would like. Another example is helping a friend assemble furniture by visually displaying which pieces go together. Another is a family member helping you cook one of the recipes by pointing out which ingredients to use and where to put them. Next, we demonstrate our approach by displaying information on the follow-up.
As you can see, that this sort of example of augmented reality is still much in its infant stages, which leads me to believe that Google Glass, even though it's sort of, you know, up and coming, it's still not going to be really that cool until that type of augmented reality is able to be utilized more in a better way. Okay. So this brings up certain questions as to copyright law. For example, one of the things I talk about in my paper is this fixation question, and Professor Friedman was wondering whether or not this would be a stretch definition. Obviously, this is such a new technology, a new issue that's bubbling up. It's hard to say, or it's hard to point to any specific case that's talking about augmented reality, viewing augmented reality in real time, and whether or not that's fixed for enough of a period that's not just transitory and that should actually be protected by copyright. I did some extra research into that and found that it is, although we don't know for sure, it seems that courts are more liable to be extremely liberal when it comes to whether something is fixed.
So you're talking whether it's protected. Is the question whether or not I have a copyright on it or whether or not I'm violating the copyright of somebody else by making a derivative work?
The question is whether or not it is copyrightable in the first place. Because
if I'm not recording it, I don't care. Considering the case where it's only transitory, I'm looking around and I'm seeing overlay on the physical reality. I don't want to copyright that, right? If I'm not recording it, what would be the point? Nobody else can copy it. But copyright does come in the question, if I'm doing that and what I'm looking at is a copyrighted work of art, have I just made a derivative work by looking at that work of art with stuff added? Do you see the question?
Yes. Okay. I think during when I was looking at your feedback, I misunderstood what your real question was. So I'm going to talk about that in a little bit, or I'm going to bring that up in a little bit, especially in terms of what I plan to explore more. Well, I'll just talk about it right now. So one of the things that I'm going to get into that I didn't yet in my paper is the idea of parity. And a lot of that entails, you know, creating some sort of, so say you look at something like the Mona Lisa or something like that, and you create an application where if you look at it, it changes it and it sort of creates some sort of parity. You know, that has implications on trademark law that I'm going to start researching and explore more because I sort of thought of it. But for copyright law, whether that's a derivative work, I think that it's a hard question because you're at that specific time, whoever's has the application installed in their device is sort of the only one seeing it. It's not changing it in the purely physical world.
It's a contributory infringement if I make software and a device which is intended to let people view other people's copyrighted works and change them. Suppose, for example, that I can let you view a play as it's happening with you as the protagonist, so that my software replaces the image of the actual actor with your with the image of the owner or somebody else. Is that a derivative work? And am I engaged in contributory infringement when I write that software and sell that equipment?
I think it should be, as long as the software was meant to work off of a specific work. So if you wrote it so that, you know, if you were watching some Disney movie and it put your and you're watching it and it put your kid's face on the on one of the characters, then I think that would be a strong case for infringement because you wrote the code to interact with the source material in that way. So there's obviously no cases of that yet. Because
what is the general purpose one where I design it so that what I do is I watch a work, I click on a character, I click on my kid's, on an image representing my kid, and then whatever the work is, the software follows that character through and always gives it my kid's face. Is that contributory infringement, given that it's not aimed at a particular work?
That's a weaker case because it's not aimed at a specific work. And I think that the more general it is, the easier it would be to argue that it shouldn't be contributory. There's some people that it seems kind of dumb, but they put stickers on their TV to make some sort of humorous, joke when they're watching TV and one of the characters' heads has like a little funny hat sticker that they put on that. Some people do a drinking game out of that, but in that case, it's so de minimis. The more general it is, the more I feel like de minimis it would be. That's why I think it would be weaker case for it.
Why don't you keep going?
Okay. So one of the other things that I guess was hard to, you know, probably hard to understand in my paper was when I was talking about the idea of functional AR versus what I call escapist AR. Both of these terms I just sort of made up. But the idea is that there's certain things that do count as augmented reality, and since it is content that is original, there's this question of what the scope of protection should be. So I was trying to come up with terms that would talk about the two extremes of, you know, functional, which should have a thin copyright, and something that I called escapist or could be called expressive or whatnot. And for let me see. So this video here.
I'm not sure I understand your sort of what kind of phase you're thinking of. So think about the heads-up display. Where does copyright? I'm driving down the road. My car superimposes. It shows me the speedometer reading as I go. Is there any copyright issue that arises there?
See, to me, that would be on the functional side of things because it's not so much.
That's functional, but how does it raise any copyright issue? I'm not videoing it.
I mean, it would be an extremely thin copyright. So if it is your, so the way that you place everything as a whole would qualify.
So what is the give me the imagined case? How does anybody infringe my copyright on what I'm seeing through my windshield if I drive along?
Okay, maybe it would be best to sort of draw.
You know, a lot of this, it seemed very hard for me to figure out what kinds of conflicts you were imagining.
Is the question, is what you're seeing copyrightable? Is that what we're discussing here? So, like, if I'm driving down, and if I'm, you know, I'm not recording anything, I'm just receiving information. Is the argument that what I'm seeing, my perspective, is somehow copyrighted?
No, the idea is sort of what's being overlaid. So think about this for an example. So you're playing some game like World of Warcraft, just to put it in a virtual reality context, or The Sims or something like that. I think Zynga was recently in a lawsuit where they were talking about the placement of certain aspects of I can't think of the word for it, but just sort of the navigation of the menus and options and all that. It looked similar to The Sims version, so they got sued over that. But the idea was that it was more of these little buttons and whatnot, it was more functional because it was just sort of menus and buttons that
the
players
can... You're going a step past what he's asking. He's not asking you're functional versus escapist. He wants to know what is the content of copyright. What are you copyrighting?
But it sounds like what you're... So say I develop driving software, and it constitutes software that you put in your glasses, and as you're going down the road,
yeah,
it tells you information in all this very specific way. And someone else comes out with a piece of software, which is also driving software. And the question is whether that driving software infringes that first person's driving software if their arrangement of the material is very similar to the first person.
Exactly. And so that is the type of case I was imagining. So think of a heads-up display where it has a combination of arrows and,
right,
and targets and all that stuff. What I was trying to argue that should only qualify at the very least for an extremely thin copyright, because there's only so many ways that you can put that together, and it's not so much, you know, fictional or expressive. It's more, if you tried to use copyright, it would sort of be like abusing that copyright to get somewhat of like patent protection.
So are you arguing therefore that in the Lotus versus Borland case, Borland should have won on those grounds?
I think that it's a good argument that the more this is, I just think that functional aspects, like menus and arrows and navigation and things like that, unless it's completely and totally copying it in every regard in the way that it looks, in a way that, you know, would probably deceive people, it shouldn't be that protectable.
I think maybe an example of that is what most people have on an iPhone or a Windows phone is the Yelp app, which uses a monocle application like this, and you can see augmented reality, the direction where there are certain like stores or restaurants or bars, and it overlays it in the sense of it being like right there on the physical property. But I think what the protection would be more likely to be is a patent, because it is functional. Use it as a resource to find factual information.
Yeah.
You're saying, like, it'd be a very thin copyright, because all you're really doing is providing some sort of a tool or...
Yeah, so in that case, you know, there's probably like a rectangle that has, you know, certain dimensions, and it's sort of transparent but dark gray. What I'm trying to say is that unless a competitor made their app look so similar in every regard, that's all that Yelp should be protected for.
But how is the fact that this has been used for virtual reality raise anything new? How is what you just said any different than if we were talking about a computer program that's a word processor? You could similarly say, you have a word processor, I have a word processor, certain features of my word processor are functional, and therefore you can't copyright your interface. So where, what's, your paper is about augmented reality. Where did augmented reality raise some special IP issues?
So the idea was to sort of to tie it back into those old, I was trying to say that the logical extension of those types of rules in virtual reality should also apply in all of these new instances that are going to be... So in the past, it's been hard to...
But his isn't a new instance. That is to say, I don't see how his Yelp thing raises any issues which aren't already in existing in non-overlay context. I was wondering whether there are IP issues, which the fact that you're doing, that's where I was trying to think about the question of whether viewing someone else's copyright work with overlays was somehow raised derivative work issues. And I'm not sure, maybe there are other places to do it, but in what you're saying now, in a sense, it seems you're making your paper less interesting if all it's doing is saying, well, exactly the same rules that already exist for everything else obviously will exist here. Take it most simply. Obviously, the actual software is protected by copyright. All right, that Yelp app is just as copyrightable as any other piece of software. So what? The fact that it's augmented reality doesn't affect that. So where are there things where it's being augmented reality raises new and interesting issues? That's
okay. I'm definitely going to take note on that and sort of develop that.
Think
more
about that. Yeah.
So and then the opposite. Wait, sorry. The opposite end of that spectrum is that. That AR applications have the potential to overlay something that's much more expressive, like a story or video game type thing, over, you know, what we consider physical reality. This is the way that you described it in my feedback might help other people understand it as well. So the way you described it was the AR equivalent of a movie or video game, an experience created by the programmer which uses the real world. Where the view is moving through as part of the experience. And this is one of the videos that I mentioned in my paper. This is extremely sort of a crude concept here. You can see it's still really buggy. I think the idea is great. As you can see, there's someone holding an iPad, which has more real estate screen-wise that you can sort of augment, so to speak, as opposed to Google Glass, which is a tiny little box in the top right of the user's view. And what they're doing here is they're in an actual graveyard, and they're overlaying an illustration of Macbeth, you know, to where they are. And based on when they're turning, they can see different things. But you can tell it's really still in its infancies, kind of.
When the hurdy-burdy sun, when the rush of again, in thunder, lightning, or in rains of sun.
So I think the idea that they're trying to get across is that you can be in a certain spot and see certain characters, and then you walk to another zone where you can see and hear other types of characters. And I think that this brings up a lot of interesting possibilities where, you know, if whoever's developing this story could actually tag it to real geographical locations, you have the possibility where you can sort of, you know, be traveling within a story. And I think in that case, you would have greater protection. The hard part is whether you would be protected.
Here's a hypothetical for you.
Okay.
Let us suppose that somebody makes software of this sort designed to let you watch the Battle of Gettysburg on the Gettysburg battlefield. And let us suppose the Gettysburg battlefield belongs to somebody. I assume it's a national park of some sort. And the owners say, we think we ought to get a cut. We think that every time that somebody uses your software to walk around our battlefield, seeing the actual battle going on, you are creating a work which combines your input with this nice scenery that happens to belong to us. Some would maybe even we've built. Maybe there's a memorial statue there or something. Therefore, you shouldn't be allowed to do it without our permission. We should get a cut to the other case or not.
I think they would, and I would analogize it more to like a video game situation. I think that the hard part is sort of, and what I was trying to do is analogize what this type of technology is to certain things that already exist. And so this would obviously be less like a movie where everything is sort of fixed and you're just watching however the director saw, you know, however they thought the sequencing should be going and where the characters would explore. in this sense, it's almost like you're putting yourself within a video game where there is sort of a hard and set geographical area that is encompassed within your app, but you have the choice to walk around from one place to another and sort of unlock the digital content however you see fit. I think that that would be more similar to a video game, which would still would, I think, cause...
I have protection for what I've done in my software. The question is, do the owners of the
geographical area
have protection? Or does anybody else? If you're trying to get what's different about this, then what's different is that you're combining your input with something else.
I see.
Trying to see where that raises issues.
I would argue yes, because you, especially if you tied that specific, and I think that this is the underlying point here, is that if you tied your app specifically to this particular geographic area, then you're using that area, whether or not you're using, you know, camera footage of it or just real.
What's the take current technology? Suppose I want to make a movie about the Battle of Gettysburg, and so I wander around the battlefield with a camera, and I take lots of movies, and I then use digital editing software to put into those movies the people doing things in my story. Do the owners of the property have any claim against over me?
I don't know if I've come across that issue in an IP context. I think that filming someone else's property would, I think that people have certain rights within having their own property. I just know, I feel like the norm is that people have to give consent for you to film their property, you know, whether it be in a TV show or a video game or whatnot. So I think that it would be the same in this context if you were tying it to that specific geographical area. If you made something that was so generalized, I think that's less of a case because
But the counter argument would be that the people who made the Gettysburg film, they're not using the area at all. It's the people who have the glasses on when they play it who are using it.
Also,
the film provides everything that wasn't in the area, right?
Yeah. Also, if those users recorded that video somehow over the other person's property,
yes.
Would they be creating?
That's interesting. Is that you've already got? What about the question? If I'm trying to generalize it, if I create a augmented reality piece of IP, which when the user uses it, is using something someone else has IP rights over, but which the user has a right to look at. All right. Imagine a museum of modern art, and presumably all of the paintings in the museum of modern art are covered by copyright, and the people who come into the museum are entitled to look at those pictures. Are they entitled to look at those pictures wearing an advanced version of Google Glass, such that what they are seeing on every picture is something additional? It might be artistic, it might be information about the artist's biography, it might be... Is IP issue going to come up? Are IP questions going to come up in that?
I think that's an interesting question. I think in reality, a lot of museums would probably try to stop people from using Google Glass in the first place. One, out of fear that they could possibly be recording it and distributing it. But in the more interesting issue, I think they want to maybe have more control over what people are doing with their IP, with what they're looking at.
How different is what I've just described from going through the museum with a guidebook, where the guidebook says this was painted by so-and-so who lived at this time, it demonstrates the following features of his style? Does it make a difference whether I'm looking at it in a separate book or whether I'm having it heads-up projected on the around the edge of the work of art?
I think the main difference is just that with those same devices that enable you to augment that reality also allow you to record it. And possibly...
The Louvre allows photography except in places where they think it might damage the works. Many museums do, many museums don't.
Yeah.
Museums don't in general eject type of their stuff photographed, some do.
Yeah. I guess I can explore that issue more.
Why don't I shut up, actually, and let the...
You raise a good question.
Yeah, I know, but we've got a whole room full of people, and I've been asking too many questions, and they should be asking questions.
So, does anyone have a question about what I consider functional versus escapist?
So functional being like the head, the thing of the seat of a car or airplane. Escapist being like the Macbeth example.
Yeah.
And actually,
you're sort of escaping physical reality via augmented reality technology, where you're sort of, so say the Gettysburg example, you're escaping physical reality present day and you know, going into some alternate reality where the battle's going on in front of you. Well, yeah, that one wouldn't necessarily be fictional, but it's still, you know, original in a sense that it would satisfy Feist, where however you portray it is sort of your own original. Way to go. The data scraping issue, I think, is going to be a big one. It's less interesting to talk about, but it's already a big issue, and I think that augmented reality is only going to accelerate that by creating a situation where it would be good to have digital data overlaid over what you're looking at, like a house. If you could look at a house and there's, you know, possibly a Zillow AR app where it tells you how much it would be worth, and then the competitors would try to scrape the database of their other competitor to get the information that would allow that. And the question there is whether or not that information was original enough to be covered under copyright in the first place. Those legal questions are sort of more devolving into unfair competition rather than IP grounds, but I think it's still, a lot of companies still try to use copyright to their advantage on that, to stop their competitors from doing that. The rest is sort of describing, you know, some of the questions I raised in my paper, but maybe it's better to, you know, in the interest of time, to just ask what, you know, everyone else thought as to certain questions in the paper. So, in the trademark context, one of the questions was what constituted improper use of another's trademark, and this is a situation that's currently, you know, a hot issue in trademarks, is the use of meta tags. Some of the feedback I got was that I should explain more what that dispute is all about, and that's when people are using competitors' marks, word marks, and all that in sort of invisible code in the header of a website to draw traffic from people that are searching for those types of terms. So when they go into Google and someone searches, Starbucks or something like that, if Pete's had something invisible in their website head that said, you know, draw in those types of people by using the phrase Starbucks, a lot of trademark owners think that that's an improper use of their mark and get really heated about it. So that's something that could be, in this context also of augmented reality, is if your augmented reality device was capable of looking at someone else's mark and then triggering some sort of content that led them to a competitor as opposed to whatever that mark was. That's a situation that I raise.
Does it matter whether it's the mark? Suppose my cell phone or whatever it is app has a map of the city, and they can see that I'm close to a Starbucks. They can maybe, if it's attached to my body, they can see that I'm facing the Starbucks. They never look at the trademark. They just say, aha, he's looking at a Starbucks. Now is the time to send him an ad for a competing product. Would that raise any issues at all?
That raises fewer issues, I think, than if you were to include something specific into your code that said, when you see this particular logo or this particular word mark, you know, we want to zap their phone with a coupon
What's in my code does not include the image of the trademark. It includes a set of numbers which are the output from looking at the trademark. Suppose what I have, in order to avoid your problem, I say, all right, when my lens is pointed at the trademark, it will see something red. Red gives the number such and such. It will see something at the top which is 1 unit wide, next down 2 units, next 3, next 2, next... Determine all these characters that you're looking at and check it, but nowhere in my code do I have your trademark. Do you have any claim against me?
That's definitely a clever way of getting around it. I think that the other side would try to argue that it's the same effect, but I think that...
Well, why is it any different from my knowing where your store is and using that effect?
Exactly. I think that, what if you just use GPS coordinates instead and said, you know, when they're approaching this GPS coordinate, I think the idea is that if they're trying to punish, or they would probably try to punish a company that was trying to get consumers who are closer to the source material, as in the mark.
Clearly, they don't want you to do it. The question is, does trademark law give them any way from any? I don't see that it does.
Yeah, probably not trademark law, but yeah.
You have a discussion of privacy, and I wanted you to follow along with, seems to me, the perfectly obvious application which fits every human male's fantasies. Namely, you look at some woman who you're interested in, and you're seeing her without any clothes on. Now, you're not really seeing her, mind you. We don't have that information. What you're seeing is a Playboy or whatever model with her head on, moving the way she moves and all the rest of it. Is that violating anybody's rights? I'm going to assume that you're not recreating her face, right? You're actually seeing the person's face. Can be a he too. I'm assuming, I don't know if women have these fantasies or not, but everybody knows they have people. So you're not actually seeing her face. All the rest of it isn't hers, right? I mean, maybe Playboy will inject, but you can doubtless find some public domain images of naked women to use. Does that violate anybody's IP rights?
I think the idea is that if it were distributed, then it probably would violate.
The software is being distributed.
Yeah.
You don't want to distribute these. These are your private fantasies of all all the sexy women in the world going naked for you. So the question is you're using the software violating anybody's rights?
I get that distinction. I just think that that's the only way that people could even catch you in the first place. So if you're distributing it, I mean, in a vacuum.
Well, you can distribute the software.
So you can distribute the software, and it would violate someone's publicity rights. I guess if you were...
You surely have no publicity right if I just do it inside my head, right? Suppose it's just fantasy. You imagine that. Hard to believe it violates any rights, so just have a little bit of high-tech supplement to your imagination.
I mean, it's hard. This intrinsic in that hypothetical is the idea that no one's probably going to catch you.
Maybe.
I think if someone...
common and then everybody just ignores it. What about, you can think of other versions of it. What about people I don't like when I see them, they've got horns, devil horns on them? Or what about, suppose I'm really sensitive, and there's this odd idea that some colors don't go with each other, which, as I may have mentioned before, my wife keeps insisting on when I get dressed. What if I've got software which is just designed to improve my environment? So that my software, I'm seeing everything the way I would be seeing it through my fancy Google glasses, except that if somebody happens to be wearing a glaringly purple shirt with a whatever purple doesn't go on pants, its color gets changed to something that fits my aesthetics. And you push forward a little bit. If you imagine a much more advanced world with a life, it doesn't have to be people, of course. Maybe I don't like certain colors of paint. You could imagine. I'm trying to get the AI to really do interesting stuff, as it were. And you could imagine a point at which what you see is the world edited in ways that convey all the relevant information. You don't want to actually bump into things, but look the way you want it to look. All right? The simple version of this that I discussed a long time ago is I'm giving a talk via some form of virtual reality, and it doesn't really matter whether or not I shave, because my computer is editing my image so I look shaved. In fact, it's taken 15 years off me, and it's giving me a haircut.
and it's removed the ketchup stains from my tie. In fact, I don't even have to wear a tie. I'm wearing a bathrobe. But the people see me as wearing a nice fancy suit and tie and so forth. And it just seems to me, if you think about that kind of image, that you start getting closer to asking what kind of issues would be raised by a augmented reality stuff that was really powerful.
Okay. I think that, I mean, I need to, yeah?
What would be the point of wearing, like, trying to dress up in their clothes or society where you make everyone look exactly how they you want them to? I mean, I can understand, like, maybe terrorists will see all women covered as they think everyone should
right.
be. And then you'll have the, as you
know, great, we'll eliminate one of the conflicts between Islamic and other societies, because we can have all the women with their faces there, and the Muslims can have all the women with their faces properly veiled.
It is your ability to portray yourself to other people. And that would just...
You're giving a reason why it ought to be illegal, which is an interesting reason. What you're saying is that in this world, putting it differently... What I said was that my software was keeping all the relevant information and editing all the aesthetic information. But I was assuming that aesthetic information isn't relevant. And maybe the fact that you choose to wear a glaringly purple shirt is actually a statement you're trying to make, and I'm not letting you make it because I'm not seeing that shit. Is that what you're, would that be an example of the point you're making?
Thank you, also.
Or in the sense I'm going to a football game or a baseball game where my team's colors, I don't want like
no, it's not like your team's colors. I'm seeing you wearing my team's colors. Everybody's wearing my team's colors.
And stop a lot of fights.
Stop a lot of fights, right, yeah. Right. Unless somebody gets behind you and looks through your glasses and they see what you're doing.
Those guys are all blue. Well, it's there's a similar conversation in like a virtual reality, how your avatar represents who you are.
Yes.
And there's a novel called Ready Player One. You heard this one? Everything happens in the virtual world. It's like a Matrix-esque world. But you can create your own avatar. You don't look like yourself. And one of the more clever things is one of the characters is an African-American woman who portrays herself as a white man to get all the benefits of being of a privileged gender and race. Because now in virtual reality, you get a pick and you can do that.
Yeah. Well, of course, that's been happening for a long time. In lower tech versions, that then you know it's the old line on the internet, nobody knows you're a dog. And I still remember, God, 20 years ago, maybe more than that, a USENET conversation on a group of people who sort of, some of whom knew each other and some of whom shared a hobby, where someone makes a not very sensible comment and somebody else sort of slaps her down pretty hard in terms of rebuttal. And so I think I emailed him asking if he knew he was arguing with a 14-year-old girl. She was the daughter of friends of mine. And of course, he didn't get sort of embarrassed about that. But in World of Warcraft, as you probably know, there's the whole question of which of the male or female characters are really male or female. And I remember my wife commenting, somebody asked her at one point if she was really a girl. And sort of her response was, well, not exactly a girl. But he said something to the effect, he thought he could tell, and he thought she was male by sort of how she played or talked or something of that sort. So that really, in a sense, is an issue that's already with us in that form. Yeah, but that's also sort of interesting. Huh, let's go further. There are people, after all, who identify, who self-identify as a gender other than their parent gender. Suppose I reverse my thing. Suppose instead of saying I get to control what I see, I get to say that everybody I look at gets to control what I see. So could you imagine a system where you don't have to bother to actually buy good clothes. You just put into your part of the computer system the description of how you want people to see you, and they, maybe they're allowed to go without any VR at all, but nobody does that. And they've got it. It's got to conform to your rules, because after all, you've got a right of personality. You've got a right to have people see you the way you want them to see you, and maybe that includes the fact that you've got a right to have them see you as female when you're really male or male when you're really female. Does that...
I mean, my perception of this was that people get to choose what they see through their own technology by what apps they download for their wearable computers. So I didn't see any situation, I didn't really explore, maybe I should, the concept of that you would be able to force other people to see you in a way that you're not. My understanding was that that's sort of not feasible, given just the way that...
I don't agree. I don't think it's very likely, but in terms of feasibility, I don't see why you couldn't imagine, given the kinds of things the Internet can do. There is, in fact, I'm pretty sure, an add-on for World of Warcraft, whose name I forget, which, if both players have it, one player can have a bunch of information about his character, which the other one can then observe. And you could imagine carrying that further so that, in effect, for everybody in the room, your machine is picking up, you know, Wi-Fi or Bluetooth or something, information from them, which says, you know, the web summary of what I look like is here, and you are supposed to feed that in. And, in fact, you could imagine it voluntarily, too. That's sort of interesting. Think about not the mandatory version, but think about the social convention, in which, just as there certainly is a social convention among some people, that if somebody is biologically male but thinks of him, of itself as female, you're supposed to treat that person as female. And you could certainly imagine, taking it further, that if I think of myself as 6 feet tall, well, you don't want to get anything off high shelves, but as far as appearance is concerned, your software can just stretch me a little bit. And I guess, I mean, everybody knows about discrimination against short people, right? I think there's some same kind of empirical evidence for other things, regressions and stuff. So I ought to have a right to be 6. Maybe even 6 foot 6. Gets less believable at some point when I can't reach things I should be able to reach.
The problem I saw with it was that I tried to imagine how these applications would come about. And I think that it would happen in a similar way that we see different marketplaces for smartphone apps right now. So we have, you know, you could go to the App Store, Apple's App Store, or you could download apps from Google's Play Store, they call it. And, you know, if you download an app on the App Store, you're not necessarily going to be seeing the same content or unlocking the same things that you would. They don't talk to each other, so to speak.
On the other hand, the different web browsers do. That is, the different web browsers, roughly speaking, show your web pages in the same way. Not perfectly, but pretty close. Think about for a moment as the early stage of what I'm describing. Doing it not via VR, but doing it via things like Skype video. Mm-hmm. So imagine that a lot of interaction is done by people in different places, just as it is already over the telephone. I was thinking, by the way, I was wondering whether a cell phone with Bluetooth is an early version of your augmented reality, because your ears are hearing a conversation from 1,000 miles away, even though your eyes are seeing something here.
I think so. What about glasses? I mean, you know,
not quite the same thing, but yeah. But imagine that we're communicating mainly via online, and it's not unreasonable what I was describing before for my imaginary lecture. We could just do personally, so that your computer takes a picture of you. It processes that picture, takes out some wrinkles, you know, fixes up whatever you want to fix up, and that's what everybody sees. And as more and more of that is happening, you really think of that person as that person, 15 years younger, a little bit handsomer, you know, different in various ways. Seems really weird if you meet them in real space and they don't look like that. Ah, we can have a solution to that problem, and our solution is going to be the augmented reality, which fixes everybody. Anyway, I don't know if it raises IP issues. I'm just trying to... it seems to me that my general view is that new things are more likely to have interesting stuff than old things, if that makes sense. If you're thinking about IP issues, an IP issue that was being raised 50 years ago, the odds you can say something new about it aren't very high. And therefore, it's interesting to try to see what are the real-world things that can come into existence with the technologies now developing. That's really what I'm trying to speculate on.
Okay. I think I see a way that I can sort of move forward and add to the paper to include those types of...
Yeah. Which one do you want to do is your decision. I'm thinking less of your paper, although that's obviously the real point of this discussion, than just of what's out there to think about that's interesting.
Yeah.
We have another paper, which obviously aren't made very much on, but if we've got the beginning of that one, which, come on, this is a wonderful way of constraining you not to talk for more than 12 minutes. The class will be over by then.
Oh, she's just
gonna... What was that?
That she was just going to walk out.
You guys don't need to talk, this is me. Okay, so my name is Kendall, and I wrote my paper for Domly talking about eminent domain and potential taking of issues within the National Institute of Health open access policy. I discovered, rereading my paper and Professor Friedman's comments, that I was very unclear about different types of eminent domain and how they worked. And because of that, I want to first give an overview of the three main types of eminent domain, how they're distinguished from each other, and then I thought I would get into some of the NIH and other open access issues. And I assume we're not going to get this until Thursday, but I also took a look at my cut aspects from my original paper, and I examined some of the concepts I had that I cut that I thought were interesting, and I thought maybe we could discuss and see if anyone had any thoughts on them. So, eminent domain is any sort of governmental organization's ability to seize private property for public use. The Fifth Amendment restricts this, not the actual physical taking of property, but it does require that when property is taken for public use, the just compensation be given to the original property holder. Now, there are three different types of eminent domain. There is a physical taking, a regulatory taking, and an unfair exaction. And the three are very distinguishable from one another. Most people are very comfortable with the concept of a physical taking. A physical taking means that in either a small or a large part, the governmental agency is actually exercising one of the bundle of rights associated with property ownership. Now, in the case of land, it generally takes the form of physically taking title to all or a portion of the land. It may also require a minimal invasion of the land, such as an electrical wire or a sewer line. And in the case of intellectual property and a patent, it would be the actual exercising of the patent. All of these are considered physical taking, and they require just compensation. And more abstractly, we have regulatory takings and unfair exactions. Now, a regulatory taking is not the federal government or any other governmental agency actually exercising a property right, but it's regulating the property owner's use of that right. So rather than the federal government saying, we are going to do this, it's landowner, you cannot do this. Most commonly, regulatory bodies are actually unconstitutional. They're not always considered a taking. In fact, generally, they're not considered a taking. Unlike physical takings, which are always a taking and will always require compensation, some regulations are not considered a taking. The most classic example is a zoning ordinance or a height restriction. We're very comfortable with these things, but a regulation can move to being an actual taking if it's essentially just considered unfair in light of all of the circumstances. And because the Supreme Court loves us, they gave us a multi-factor balancing test that is unique to every single fact pattern that may appear. It's called the Penn Central analysis. Penn Central was a giant train station in downtown New York. New York Historical Society wanted to protect the building. They passed regulations stating that certain things couldn't be done. The owner of the building wanted to build an office tower on top of it. It was very angry. Sued the city. There was a lot of litigation. Ultimately, the Supreme Court said it was not a regulatory taking, and it's a balancing test where you take the state interest in the regulation, what does that regulation itself does to the state, and you balance it against the state interest in the property, in full property rights. So it's kind of like trademark where you're balancing the state interest in both, but the state interest in allowing people to have property and to use the property effectively. Then moving on to unfair exactions. Unfair exactions are very different. A lot of people sometimes classify unfair exactions as a subset of regulatory takings. They really are distinct, because an unfair exaction actually involves a contractual relationship between the government agency and the landowner. Now, in this, when I say landowner, I really mean property owner. It applies to any form of property that's most commonly found in the land use sphere. And most of the cases involving both regulatory takings and exactions are found in land use sphere rather than in chattels. And just for the record, I didn't find any actual instances of regulatory takings and unfair exactions within intellectual property, which is why a lot of the paper was very theoretical. But as far as unfair exactions, So the classic cases for under attachment are called Nolan and Dolan. And there are theories where a landowner wanted to develop a piece of property, and they went to the overarching body to try and get building permits. And the individual building permit said, okay, well, we'll give you these building permits, but you have to do these other things in order to get the building permit. In the case of Nolan, it was a walkway to a public walkway to the beach. In the case of Nolan, it was a public walkway along the river in Tiger, Oregon. So they accepted that agreement, that contract with the city, and then subsequently said, well, this is a taking. This is an unfair exaction. It's really about an unfair contract provision. It kind of comes out of when there's unfair bargaining power, a provision that regularly would be considered a sensible contract provision. You didn't really have the ability. So in a regulatory taking, the real principle is that the landowner doesn't really have the ability to negotiate with the government. They aren't on equal footing. The government has the ability to say, you have to do X, Y, and Z, or we will not allow you to build, which means they can't use their property to the highest and best use. So as a result, they agree, okay, we're going to have this, we're going to go through with these exactions, but then they will subsequently challenge them in court, say they're unfair. Again, not all exactions are unfair, just like not all regulatory schemes are unfair. Most exactions are associated with the effect the land use will have on the infrastructure of the local community. Most often they're for sewer capacity, to increase access to public lands. So sometimes there actually been issues where there was requirements for public art that be on property that was upheld. It really is balancing. Again, it's another balancing test. So unfair exactions, the test really is, again, there's not really a bright line rule. It's more just, is it unfair looking at all the circumstances and all the facts? Essentially, the courts are supposed to examine whether or not whether or not it's unfair, whether or not they were using their authority to get something for the community for public use that they would not otherwise be able to get. And so initially, exactions only apply when someone has actually made the agreement. And this was a case last term called Kuntz, which held that exactions can exist when a regulatory body denies a permit because the individual will not agree to the provisions that the governing agency wants them to follow. So that's a basic overhaul of three main types of eminent domain. And I want to make sure that nobody has any questions, because I know I wasn't very clear in the paper about the distinction between the three, and I want to make sure that if anyone's confused, I can relate it. Is everybody happy? Okay, so moving on. So my best friend is a rocket scientist, and she is working at the University of Washington, and she writes a lot of intellectual property or intellectual academic papers. She does research for Boeing, she does research for NASA, she does research for Department of Defense. She has a lot of this, and she wants to become an academic, and as a result, she needs to be published. So the problem is within the academic community, in order to get published, you have to write something else that's very well known. But in order to actually be published, you have to turn over your entire copyright to the publishing house, or alternatively, you're going to speak speak at a conference, you have to, again, turn over your entire copyright. Which, for most academics, it doesn't really bother them because, well, whatever. They want to speak, they're more interested in speaking than they are in keeping the copyright. They aren't going to get profit out of this paper. It's really more about being published, the prestige of being published, and also the ability to communicate their ideas with the rest of the population, with the rest of the academic community. So the problem is with modern publishing practices, it's very, very difficult for most academics, or many academics, to actually get full access. I wrote a little bit about it, but there's actually a really, really, really amazing article. It's not just talking about scientific community, it's talking about academics. and I just forgot the name of it. It's Dance Our Alarm last year. Jorge Contreras. The Contreras is the last name. It's phenomenal. And he's talking about a lot of the issues. This is how I kind of learned a little bit about more about open access and the general movement. So the problem is, if an academic doesn't have access, if you don't work for a very prestigious university, the university may not be able to afford subscription to any and all academic journals, which would then limit your access to what journals your particular institution has the ability to access. And one of the great things about the internet is that anyone can access anything that's on the internet. So there is a movement to try and open up access, to try and put publications online, to try and get as much access as possible around the world. The problem is a lot of publishing houses are really fighting against this. They don't want public access. They want to keep things, because how the way they increase revenue is by getting subscriptions to major universities. So in response to this problem, the National Institute of Health instituted what they call their open access policy. So the open access policy states that any academic research which is funded by the National Institute of Health, which is published, must be made publicly available on either the NIH's website or on another website. It must be made on the internet available within 12 months of publication. It's not a requirement that it be available the same time it's published, not a requirement that it be downloadable or copyable, only that it be that people be able to read it online. So the access to the information, not necessarily to a physical copy of the article. And I think we're just about out of time.
Mm-hmm.
We can pick this up. We can talk about whether or not it's taking you on Thursday.
Right. Thank you.
Exciting.